setting wouldn't change, yet his captivating performance mesmerized the audience.
The late Mohammad Kasabi had joined theater at the age of 13 and later majored in acting and directing. But the reason behind his popularity went beyond his award-winning performance.
In addition to his professional performance, this prominent actor was devoted to the Islamic Revolution and the celebration of its heroes, whom he tried to portray in the best way possible. The deep respect he expressed for martyred General Soleimani left an enduring memory of him in the hearts of Iranians. Everyone knows him as an actor, but even though acting was in his blood, his true passion lay in social issues and the revolution.
Kasabi had a remarkable talent for portraying the struggles of ordinary people. His outstanding performance in the movie The Father, for instance, earned him Best Actor Award in the Fetch Film Festival. His concern for the conditions of the oppressed, however, knew no borders.
He had genuine concerns about the world, about Palestine, and especially about Gaza. Even recently, while he was bedridden, he would sometimes call me to express his ideas and discuss what could be done for the people.
Like all who depart this world, Mohammad Kasabi left behind his awards and earthly possessions. But unlike many, his body was carried by a sea of mourners, all praying that his good deeds be granted the highest reward. If, as Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage, then Iranian actor Mohammad Kasabi played his part with integrity. His success can be measured not only by the awards his works won, but by the moral impression they left on people's hearts long after the curtain fell. Mariam Azarcher, Tehran.
The Islamic movement traced its history to the late 1970s and early 1980s, a period marked by ideological ferment among Nigerian university students. The movement was heavily influenced by the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, which demonstrated the triumph of faith over tyranny. Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki emerged as a leading voice calling for the revival of Islam as a complete way of life.
Suddenly we heard about the success of that revolution, which actually showed us that what we have been yearning as an aspirant is possible because it has happened elsewhere. So that boosted our morale. Whenever we attend Islam, we attend also because we believe that it is only Islam that can unify the people, and it's only Islam that can provide justice.
The Islamic movement has endured decades of persecution, social isolation, massacres, and sometimes media blackout. But the movement has survived and has continued to grow from strength to strength. Members of the movement said the reasons are very obvious.
The first and first in Allah's promise to assist the oppressed and to assist those who strive in his path. That's one. Two, we have a leadership that has unwavering stand against tyranny and oppression and is steadfast. And there is thirdly, there is a team, or rather, followership. The followership are educated and dedicated.
The Islamic movement vigorously pursued the unity of all Muslims, irrespective of denomination, and pushing for the reformation of the human soul, increasing moral discipline and God consciousness. More and more Nigerians have now understood the goals and objectives of the Islamic movement and are joining the cause.
The Sheikh Zizeki made me to more closer to him, and I decided to join the movement. Because the movement is not only for Muslims alone. Other people, pastors, we have many pastors there now who also join the movement, and we are fighting this cause together. If this man is preaching peace, trying to bring us together, what he stands is what I believe. Justice, fairness, and equity.
The Islamic movement says it stands today as one of the most disciplined and ideologically grounded movements in Africa. The movement stresses that truth cannot be silenced, and that spiritual purification, knowledge, unity, and justice reflect the timeless essence of Islam. Tanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
welcome to Women of Resistance. Despite being severely visually impaired, Samahar Al-Naji managed to live a normal life. She knew every nook and corner of her home and didn't need to see to function optimally. Surrounded by her husband and sons, she found some comfort in the occupied land, despite the constant threats and harassment from the IOF. But she lost all that in the ongoing genocide being perpetrated by the Zionist regime on Gaza. Losing her husband and being constantly displaced from one place to another, she says it's hard to mentally map out her ever-changing surroundings. Her sons, meanwhile, suffer from seizures and anxiety due to the constant fear as their bodies are consumed by rashes due to the constant insect bites that take over the tents in summer. Here is the story of Samaha.
Palestinians have always lived in service to others, regardless of their personal circumstances. A desire to do for others has often helped this community at the very worst of times. Being visually impaired at the best of times under Israeli occupation would be a struggle, but Samer tried to live a life, a full life, despite the challenges. She would need that resilience for the darker days ahead. Samer recounts an example of some of the injustices suffered at the hands of Israel during this time and the lessons in defiance that were taught by her family, especially her mother. Samer and her family knew that one of the best weapons at her disposal was education. Existing in the midst of a genocide is a life or death struggle. Now imagine that fight with a pronounced disability, without a husband's protection, and with children deeply impacted and likely suffering from severe PTSD. There seems a deliberate cruelty in the ways in which the disabled and vulnerable are treated now. The genocide has made existing obstacles nigh on impossible to overcome and added an additional layer of inhumanity that makes life almost unbearable. There is a powerful Palestinian rebuke of the Western plans for Gaza. The unrelenting grind of life is only made bearable with God's grace. The litany of issues Samer and her boys must wrestle with each day reads almost like a horror novel. For Palestinians like Samer, the concept of Arab unity is dead and buried like Gazans under the rubble. For Palestinians to have a fighting chance, there has to be a coming together of the Ummah. Samer's story is sadly not unique. The Western-backed Israeli genocide has cost Palestinians so much, and it's a debt that the world can never truly repay. But perhaps we can begin the process of atonement by listening carefully to what Samer has to say.
Joining me in the studio today to discuss Samaha's struggles is Aveline McCogan, an activist with the Spartacist League, a Marxist group. Welcome, Aveline.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me, Sakina.
And you're most welcome. Aveline, you know, any woman, every woman and man and child in Gaza today is going through a really difficult situation. But, you know, Samahar's problems are compounded by the fact that she's blind. And not just that, but, you know, if we, the stories of her children, the trauma they are living through, you know, having seizures because of the things that they see. You know, when this is over, if at all they survive the genocide, you know, are these children scarred forever? What kind of a generation are we looking at in the future?
Thank you. Very good question. She's obviously an extraordinary woman, and I think the courage and determination that she shows, in spite of all the obstacles, is symbolic of the struggle of the whole Palestinian nation to survive, to refuse to be written out of history by the genocidal war of Israel. So, and I think her courage is a very good illustration of what drives the Palestinian national liberation struggle. And I'm glad you mentioned the youth and the trauma that they suffer, which is unimaginable. But also your question points to the future. And I think the most important thing there is to draw the political lessons. If I may mention Northern Ireland, I grew up in Ireland, and although the armed struggle ended there in 1998, the young generation still experiences trauma of a struggle that they did not even live through. And I think there's a lesson there. The lesson is that as long as the national oppression exists, Britain's not driven out of Northern Ireland, as long as the national oppression of the Palestinians exists, that trauma will not go away. If I may mention something for your viewers in Iran, there was a lot of sympathy for the Irish struggle in Iran, and in the early 1980s, they renamed a street in Tehran for Bobby Sands, who's a hero of the Irish national struggle. I believe it was a street that ran very near to where the British embassy was. So that was nice.
Absolutely, and I know Iranians have supported the cause of liberations and justice throughout the world, really. At the moment, you know, they are paying the price. We just saw the 12-day war that happened, illegal war. The Lebanese, the Yemenis, you know, have paid the price for supporting, you know, the cause of justice. But on the other hand, you know, Samahar talks about the fact that their neighbors, their brothers, the Arab nations, you know, they don't see them. The reality is that they see them, but they close their eyes to their plight. I mean, UAE, we've just heard recently, has condemned the Palestinian attack on, you know, the settlers, the Israelis, who are actually the occupiers, but they don't see what is happening in Gaza. What is possessing them, these Arabs?
Let me just say, first of all, since you mentioned the war on Iran, my organization, in the Palestine demonstration in London, immediately after that war, our banner said, stand with Iran and Palestine, because many groups on the left here did not stand with it even under that attack. Okay, but to your broader question, it's a very good question. What about the Arab regimes? And I think the same question also applies to the axis of resistance. And so to answer the question, I just want to zoom out a little bit to what is the overall global situation there. American imperialism is top dog, dominates the world. Israel is the armed fist of American imperialism in the region. And part of what they do, in addition to the genocide of the Palestinians, the overall effect is they set the peoples of that region against each other, divided along religious lines, Shia versus Sunni, ethnic lines, and so on. And those regimes that you rightly point the finger at, their priority is always to protect their own power base, to maintain themselves in power, to maintain stability in their own countries. And that puts them against the interests of the masses in their own countries, and the support of the Palestinians is never their priority. Now, similar thing can be said about the movement in the West, but my point is, a winning strategy for the Palestinians, we think, should look to the masses of those countries to rise up in a mighty struggle against those regimes, against imperialism, and against Israel, as opposed to looking to...
Absolutely, couldn't have said it better. I've been very interested, you know, how you've described the situation in the Middle East and, you know, the different factions and what they stand for. Let's come here to, you know, to the West now. You know, we're in Britain, in the belly of the beast, so to say,
yes,
because we created the occupation in the first place.
Yes.
We see a UK that is in shambles right now. I think anybody can accept that, you know.
Yes.
The government will be going, you know, reshuffling because of corruption scandals. We thought we were in the past. you know, with the Tory government, it's becoming fascist, or maybe it's always been fascist. But do you think the curtains on October 7th have been lifted and we are seeing the West for what it truly is?
I think certainly the momentum within Britain is driving to the right. And I think the key question for is there's been huge support for Palestine, for example, in Britain, and you know, massive demonstrations. We have participated in those demonstrations, but always under our own banners. So why, in spite of all those demonstrations for almost 2 years now, is the momentum, why is the direction of motion going to the right? And why have the demonstrations, the mass support for the Palestinian cause, not been turned into an opposition to the Starmer government, which is has been arming the genocide? And part of the problem with that, we think, is political. The pro-Palestine movement is very much tied to liberalism, which is tied to the established order, the British political establishment. And the British political establishment is a lackey of American imperialism, and so it's a red line for the British ruling class that you must support Zionist State of Israel in everything that it does. So
how do we get out of this? Can we ever get out of it?
Yes, we can get out of this, but it is a challenge. For example, a new party has been declared in Britain by Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana, formerly Labour members of Parliament. For that party to succeed, we think that a number of things must happen. First of all, they must ditch liberalism, break with liberalism. They must turn to the working class. It is in the interest of the working class to fight against British imperialism. They are the force that can do it. But the left, and including the Corbyn movement of the past, has alienated the working class. So we think they must be organized as a force that will win the working class. And on the question of Palestine, they must clearly say no to Zionism, you know, within the new party.
Absolutely, there is no room for that at all, especially in this time. But I think very quickly, we are almost out of time. You're talking of the working class. Your organization fights for the working class. Very briefly tell me, you know, what is it that you do and how are you linked to the Palestinian activism?
We seek to rebuild the socialist and communist movement on a solid political foundation against imperialism, against Zionism, and against the ruling class, whether in the Middle East, but also here. And that means drawing a lot of lessons from the past, from the failures of the past, and, you know, putting forward a strategy for now, for a strategy to win.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's so fascinating for me, you know, when I hear people from such different political, cultural, religious, you know, outlooks, but at the same time, from whichever angle we are coming at, it's a common cause of justice, you know, against imperialism and fighting for the humanity of people like those of Palestinians. Thank you so much, Evelyn. I really appreciate you being with me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you. We leave you with the sounds of Palestine by the artist Saif. Until next time, goodbye.
Salam and welcome, friends, near and far. This is Iran Radio coming to you from Tehran, and I'll be your guide through a rich tapestry of sound stories of faith, voices of thought, and the pulse of the world in motion. Keep listening, because what's ahead is worth your time. Our next program is Leader's Speech. Listen to English translations of selected segments and speeches by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on various important occasions. Following this program, we have another segment of radio productions for this hour. Next up, we have Africa Today. For now, please stay with us for Leader's Speech.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with veterans of the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on September 20th, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. One achievement was that the Iranian nation discovered the greatness of its capabilities. Consider the younger ladies and gentlemen who came and spoke here today. They keep saying that we should apply and use the techniques used during the imposed war, the sacred defense, and the administration and management of the country, and the economy, and in other such areas. What does this mean? It means that during the sacred defense, the capabilities of the Iranian nation were seen so clearly that everyone wants to follow those approaches in all sections of the management of the country, the development of the country, and the growth of the country. In other words, the sacred defense brought an image in front of the Iranian nation that allowed it to recognize itself. What we were told throughout history and the way we were treated was the opposite of this. During the period of the Qajar and during the period of the Pahlavi, it was continuously instilled in us that we can't, that we aren't anyone important, that we aren't worthy of anything, and that the world powers are able to wipe us off the face of the earth with one motion. This is what we were taught. They had always told us that we should learn from them, that we should follow them, and that we should ask them for things. The sacred defense showed us otherwise. It showed us that those very people whom some still depend on and pin their hopes on join forces and take action against our nation, but can't do a damn thing. The sacred defense showed the Iranian nation this. So, we discovered our own capabilities. We realized that a young man like the martyr Hassan Bagheri, not to mention those who are alive, as we have plenty of similar people who are still alive, gets up and goes to the battlefields and becomes a strategist in a short period of time. In other words, he becomes a defense and war strategist. Is such a capability a joke? Where was this talent? Martyr Hassan Bagheri was a young man. He was a newspaper reporter. He wrote articles for the Jomhuri Islami newspaper. This talent flourished. We have thousands of similar examples of such talent, such as talent in construction.
Oh, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Jahan Square, one of the biggest and most beautiful squares in the world. A UNESCO World Heritage Site that must be on your bucket list. Naqsh Jahan Square is located in the center of the city of Isfahan. It was built during the 17th century, during the Safavid era. This square, with its rich historical background, is one of the most spectacular attractions of the city of Isfahan. On the western side of Naqsh Jahan Square, you find an exquisite palace which is known as Ali Qapu. It was built during the Safavid era and it was considered the political center of the country. Ali Qapu literally means Great Gate. The palace is actually a six-story building, but you won't realize this until you go to the backyard. It was here that the Safavid king would entertain his special visitors. He also celebrated Nowruz, the Persian New Year.
We've just been to the palace. It's absolutely beautiful. We went up the staircase to the number of levels. We just saw the amazing decorative artwork. And then went up to the top chamber where we believe the musicians used to play, the amazing acoustics.
This amazing structure is rich in wall paintings. The doors, walls, and ceilings are highly ornamented with intricately designed floral motifs. On the sixth floor is where royal receptions were held and was referred to as the music hall. One of the main attractions of Naqsh Jahan Square are the mosques that are located in it. Mosques that are not only considered masterpieces of Iranian Islamic architecture, but that are famous for their tile works. Imam Mosque, also known as Jame Abbasi Mosque, is on the south side of the square. It is considered an excellent example of the Islamic era architecture of Iran. Its splendor is mainly due to the beauty of its seven-color tiles. Probably the most amazing part of this mosque is its tile works. The tiles are so intricately designed that you can even find postcards and replicas of them around the square. The magnificent tile work serves a double function. Aside from ornamenting the mosque, there was a need to weatherproof the simple clay bricks used in its construction. The tiles are decorated in seven colors, which is why they are called haftrang, which literally means seven colors.
so big and colourful. And what else then?
Yeah, the tiles and the decorations are amazing, aren't they?
You can find one of the most exquisite masterpieces of Iranian architecture, Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, which was built by Shah Abbas I of the Safavid dynasty.
What fascinates me most about this mosque is, first of all, architecturally it's a unique work. We don't have anything like that in any part of Iran or elsewhere, because it's a private mosque built for the father-in-law of Shah Abbas the Great. In terms of ornament, what fascinates me most is the interplay of natural tile colors with various sorts of blue color, and these in the whole composition, the composition of natural tile color with blue. That's unique, and that's very nice.
I can't tell you enough about the beauty of Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, but in my opinion, the most amazing part is the tile work under the dome. And if you're familiar with Persian carpets, you will find this design quite familiar. Bazaar of Isfahan is one of the oldest and largest bazaars in the Middle East. Some parts of it are more than 1,000 years old. The bazaar is abundant in handicrafts, so if you're looking for a little something to take back, this is where you need to go. Probably one of the most interesting parts of Naqsh-e Jahan Square is Qaisariya Bazaar, one of the longest bazaars in the world that connects Naqsh-e Jahan Square to Atiq Square. It's about 8 kilometers long. The square is still as vibrant as it was, today mostly with the presence of tourists rather than merchants, but is still reminiscent of its days of glory, when public ceremonies were held, Nowruz was celebrated, and polo games were played. Now, after all of these amazing things, there's only one thing I can say. Visiting Naqsh-e Jahan Square must be on your bucket list. Gizum Shahmadi for Iran. Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
As the U.S. closes doors, China is opening new ones and redefining Africa's place in the world. There is talk of the continent turning Trump's punitive tariffs into a new opportunity. Now, will Africa rise to reshape its destiny, or will it be left behind in the global power struggle? And joining us today to discuss this important topic is Irete Bakara Yusuf. Now, she is a broadcast journalist and founder of African Journalists Against Genocide. Also with us today is Zizwe Chiduka. Now, he is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we discuss how African countries can turn Trump's punitive tariffs into an opportunity. When the United States raised tariffs on African exports to as high as 30% in the case of South Africa, shockwaves rippled across the continent. Overnight, billions in trade were at risk. Uganda, Gabon, and Niger had already lost their duty-free access under a U.S. program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act. For many, it felt like punishment, but for Africa, it could be a wake-up call. Because while Washington is shutting doors, Beijing is opening. By 2024, Africa-China trade had surged past $295 billion. In just the past 5 months of 2025, it added another $134 billion. Factories, ports, and railways financed by China are changing the way Africa connects with the world. At the same time, African nations are rethinking their own future. The African Continental Free Trade Area is laying the foundations for the world's largest single market. Across the continent, a new spirit of self-reliance is taking hold. Now, these tariffs aren't just about economics. They are moves in a global power struggle over currency, over alliances, over the future of trade itself. Now, the question is, will Africa turn exclusion into power and claim its place in the new multipolar world order?
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently addressed a virtual BRICS leaders' extraordinary summit that focused on the current economic environment and the state of the multilateral system. Now, commenting on the tariffs war imposed by the U.S., he said that we are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges and opportunities. Let's take a listen.
We are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges as well as opportunities in the reordering of the global economy. There is a shift from a unipolar to a multipolar world. This moment is marked by intensifying global competition and growing geopolitical tensions. Unilateral tariff actions are contributing to an increasingly protectionist environment, which poses great hardships and danger for the countries of the Global South. The uncertainty of the new trading regime has already negatively affected employment levels in my own country, South Africa, and is an obstacle to our economic growth. We are therefore supportive of meaningful BRICS initiatives that improve the resilience of our economies as BRICS countries.
Well, the South African president, they are speaking of new opportunities for Africa amid the trade war imposed by the U.S. president on Africa. Now, let's start off with Irete Bakara Yusuf. Given the recent discussions surrounding the tariffs imposed on African exports by the U.S., do you believe Africa should view these as an opportunity to reduce its reliance on Western markets?
I think it's important that Africa begins to
actually take control and steer and sort of pull away more and more from its dependency on Western markets. Why is that? Because Africa needs to realize the only way that Africa can grow is to continue or begin to do more and more business with the within themselves, within Africa, across the region, and, you know, pull away from the powers that the Western region had over Africa. Indeed, the only way we can actually begin to see a growth and, if you like, a Viva Africa, and a fully independent Africa, an Africa that works for Africans and indeed her massive youth, is to actually continue to do business.
Thank you. Now, let's bring in Zizwe Chiguka. Do you think Africa's ongoing efforts to reduce reliance on the U.S. through initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area will help shield the continent from the impacts of a U.S. trade war?
The Africa Free Trade Agreement will definitely help to buffer the African nation states against the tariff policies of the current U.S. administration. Basically, because Africa is the richest continent on earth, and the economies of Africa, they need to be integrated so that they're not so dependent on foreign direct investment or foreign markets. Many of the nation states in Africa are dependent upon U.S. foreign market for sales, but if we integrate the economies of Africa, and the African Free Trade Agreement is a step in that direction, we'll become less dependent upon the U.S. economy as a foreign market.
President Donald Trump's aggressive tariff policies, particularly the imposition of reciprocal tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries with trade surpluses with the U.S., have significantly disrupted global trade dynamics. African nations heavily reliant on U.S. markets for exports like textiles, agriculture, and minerals have been among the most affected. In response, many are actively seeking new markets across Asia to mitigate the adverse economic impacts.
President Trump's recent decision to exempt key African minerals like gold, tungsten, uranium, and graphite from U.S. tariffs has raised questions about the underlying motives of his trade policies. Now, the administration justifies these exemptions as necessary to secure critical supply chains vital for sectors like aerospace, electronics, and energy. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how do you interpret this move?
The Trump administration could not put tariffs on those rare earth minerals because of the need for those rare earth minerals. It's the same thing in Africa. There are certain things, mineral resources, like uranium, coltan, etc. The administration in the U.S. cannot afford to put tariffs on those kinds of things because of the need. So they take people as food, basically, when they have these economic arrangements and negotiations with other countries. And it's also a result of colonialism in the past in Africa that the U.S. government is able to bully people in Africa, the governments in Africa, in terms of making these arrangements to the detriment of the economy of the African nation states. So unification is the key. The integration of the African economy will stop all of those problems that the colonialists and imperialists are trying to impose on the African nation states.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chiguka. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on punitive U.S. tariffs on Africa and how they can be turned into an opportunity for the continent. Stay with us.
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
African Continental Free Trade Area stands as a cornerstone of Africa's development vision under Agenda 2063. Now, a unified market holds immense potential, unlocking boundless opportunities for the continent's growth and prosperity. The Secretary General of this Pan-African body elaborates on the opportunities.
By the year 2035,
the AFCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AFCFTA market is estimated to be close to $7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AFCFTA.
Well, as Africa continues to develop its economic strategies, initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area are undermining the U.S. Multilateral trade frameworks with Africa, such as the so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. This is seen by many as presenting an opportunity for Africa to push for stronger economic integration within the continent itself. Ms. Bakare Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, AGOA, really, yes, Nigeria, my country, was one of the largest users, if not the largest users of AGOA, but, you know, that no longer exists. And again, AGOA was just a way of, you know, it was the American soft power way of controlling African countries. So certainly, we should get to that. And I can't say, I can honestly say for myself, I am one of those who sees this as a great, great opportunity for Africa to free itself of the American stronghold. But the question is Africa ready? They need our resources. The same President Trump that's imposing tariffs on South Africa, on Nigeria, etc., that's weaponizing tariffs, is actually, they need the rare earth. He's talking about, oh, I'm stopping the war in Congo, you know, in exchange for natural resources. Well, he hasn't even stopped any war, but I have no doubt he's probably signed the natural resources on how to steal from Congo, how to steal from Sudan, how to steal from Nigeria. Heck, how to steal from as many parts of Africa as possible. And those are the things that we need to stop from happening. If African countries had led the initiative and ensured that the war in Congo, the genocide going on, is actually stopped and they're able to get there and stop it, talk to their brother leaders, put a stop to it, then we wouldn't have had a President Trump who would be able to interlude and claim that he stopped a war, which he hasn't stopped. And must keep saying that. He hasn't stopped. What he did was to sign a contract to collect more minerals, to steal, not collect, to actually thieve and steal more minerals from Africa in the future, in order to do a short ceasefire that only lasted a few days.
The exclusion of African countries from AGOA presents a significant new opportunity for the continent to reconsider and potentially break free from trade agreements that may have restricted its long-term growth and potential. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how has AGOA's narrow focus on specific industries and reliance on external partners hindered the continent's ability to diversify its economies and pursue more self-sustaining models of development?
I definitely think that this is an opportunity for Africa to unify economically, politically, socially. On the economic front, the African Growth and Opportunities Act was a thing that was used by the imperialist powers to keep a dependency relationship of these newly independent African states. So this would work in our favor to spark a change in Africa to further integrate the African economy. And so the U.S. administration is helping to mobilize our people for greater forms, levels of unity on the economic front. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that they are actually trying to impose these tariffs. So now we can integrate our economies and be less dependent on the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which is to disfavor the African nation states anyway.
China's expanding influence in Africa represents a significant shift from the historically exploitative engagement of Western powers, particularly the United States. Many analysts view the increase increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative to the punitive tariffs often associated with U.S. economic policy.
There's a China-Africa summit every year in which the Chinese forgive the debt of many African nation states, and also China has helped to build infrastructure projects throughout Africa, such as the Trans-Am Railroad back in the 70s. So that relationship with China has always been a positive, and is increasingly becoming even better with their help financially and economically, so that we are less dependent upon the U.S. and the European imperialists that charge astronomical interest rates on these loans that they give us. Because if you look at all the nation states in Africa that have taken out International Monetary Fund loans, they're still paying the interest and they can't even get to the principal. So therefore, the indebtedness of African nation states to IMF is continuing to rise, whereas China is helping and forgives many of the loans so that we can become less dependent on the International Monetary Fund in Africa.
In response to the U.S.'s aggressive trade policy, there is a growing argument for African countries to focus on de-dollarization and create more independent trade structures within the global south. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how can de-dollarization and the establishment of independent trade structures help African countries mitigate the impact of external